Good morning. The scripture lesson today is Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 10, taken from the New Revised Standard Version. Please stand for the reading of the gospel if you are able. Then the kingdom of the heaven will be like this. 10 bridesmaids took their lamps up and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and slept. But at midnight, there was a shout, "Look, here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him." Then all those bridesmaids got up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise replied, "No, there will not be enough for you and for us. You had better go to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they went to buy it, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. The word of God for the people of God.
It is my great privilege this morning to introduce our guest preacher, the Reverend Dr. Wayne Barrett. Wayne is the past director of the United Methodist Foundation. He still is a part of the foundation as its senior executive. He is also in charge of the Michigan Area Loan Fund. He has had a long and illustrious career as an expert in church finance. Between our two services today, Wayne is going to be available giving a presentation in the lounge about church endowment giving and be available as well. If you would like to have a follow-up conversation with Wayne, you can schedule an appointment with him, and he would be more than happy to talk to you about how you can support the life and ministry of First United Methodist through its endowment. I first met Wayne just about 20 years ago, I think about 21 years ago, when the little church I was serving in New Buffalo was going for a Miracle Sunday to raise some funds for a new parsonage. And we invited Wayne to come down. He has done so many of these, I'm sure he probably doesn't remember this one, but we invited him to come down, and he walked us through the process, gave us some tips, and I said at one point in the meeting, as a kind of a young pastor just starting out, I said, maybe we should invite the bishop down to see if the bishop would come and speak. And Wayne just looked at me and said, "Oh, Brad, you can preach as well as the bishop. You should handle it." And I have never forgotten that compliment, Wayne. It was a great gift to a young pastor starting out. So thank you for that, and thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to see Constance here this morning. I hadn't seen her in a while. I've known Constance for about 40 years, and she observed, "You look somewhat different." I guess I do. Now, matter of fact, I admit I reached that stage in life when I pay much more attention to the obituaries than I used to. And I figured any day my name doesn't show there is a good day. But we have observed this last year, we've lost a lot of the great preachers in our denomination here in the state of Michigan. Several that you would know. And one day we were riding along in the car, my wife and I was talking about the fact that some of the great pulpiteers had passed away, and I said, "You know, I wonder how many really great preachers we have left in the United Methodist Church here in Michigan." And Linda looked at me, as wives sometimes do, and she said, "Well, probably about one less than you think." Well, okay, I get the point. But a number of years ago, if you had asked who's probably the greatest preacher in the state of Michigan in our denomination, there's probably not much doubt. Overwhelmingly, people would have named Dr. Henry Hitt Crane, who at that time was senior pastor at the historic Central Methodist Church in downtown Detroit, what some people call, you know, Our Lady of Comerica Park. It's right next door to the ballpark there. And Dr. Crane was famous not only in Michigan, but all across the United States. He was widely in demand as a speaker. And one year he was asked to be the baccalaureate speaker at Duke University. Now, though this was many years ago, they warned him that even then, these young people weren't anxious to get up and go to church on a Sunday morning. So it was kind of a a hostile crowd. So he began to figure out, what do I do to capture their attention? And so he got up and he said, well, when I accepted this invitation, I realized that I had to come up with a topic. And there are really only two topics to talk about. I could talk about things or I could talk about people. And I've always found people much more interesting than things, so I quickly determined I would speak to you about people. And then I realized there's two kinds of people. There are men and there are women. And because I'm a man, I found women much more fascinating than men, so I determined I would speak to you about women. And then in doing a little research, I discovered there are two kinds of women as well. There are wise women and there are foolish women. And today I'm here to talk to you about foolish women. Well, I don't know if you'd get away with that on the college campus anyplace in the United States today. And in fact, there have been times I wondered whether you should even preach on this text in today's United Methodist Church. So when given that kind of ambiguity, I checked with my PC coach, Bishop Sharon Rader. And I asked Bishop Rader, I said, is it still okay to preach about the topic of the wise and the foolish maidens? She said, well, of course you can speak on that. It's in the New Testament. It's, you can talk about it. I said, but shouldn't we make it more modern and maybe make it more inclusive and have men and women in the story? She said, oh, no, it's got to be women. And I said, why does it have to be all women? She said, to be believable. No one would ever believe that as many as 5 out of 10 guys could get it all together. So we go back to an ancient story. A story that Jesus told to help us understand something about our lives. And like so many of these parables of Jesus, it's not really about first century wedding practices. It's about planning. And all like all the parables, it has a point to do it about planning. And the point is, you should plan, that is. Now, the fact of the matter is, all of us have plans. Just some of them prove not to be very good plans, as was true back in the first century with these wise and foolish women. Now, nobody sets out to create a plan that won't work. Most everybody thinks their plans will work, or if nothing else, they've got another plan, which is I'll plan to have a plan one of these days. But the most common reason that these plans don't work is we never get around to actually doing it. I used to, when I was serving a church in Muskegon, I had a poster in my office, a picture of a big green frog. And underneath that frog's photo was these words, thought for the day. If you plan to swallow a frog, it's best not to look at it too long. Has that been your appreciation of it? I mean, it seems like you have all these great ideas. You pick that rascal up, but the longer you hang on to it, it kind of grows on you, and less likely you'll do anything with it. And that's the way it was in the first century as well. I don't think any of these 10 young women said, I'm going to see if I can miss the wedding feast. No, they all planned to go there, and you need to know a little bit about what was going on in the first century to understand the context of it. Now, in those days, they had a much more relaxed attitude about time. I noticed this church has a fairly relaxed attitude about time. We have 900 United Methodist churches in Michigan. I've been to about 600 of them, and nearly all of them have clocks. And I've developed a theory that people put their clocks where they're needed most. If it was most important for the congregation to know what time it was, the clock would be up here. Most of them seem to think it's important that the preacher know what time it is, so they tend to put them in the back. First Church doesn't seem to care what time it is, so you don't have one. But in the first century, you got invited to a wedding feast. It was sort of like a slumber party. But unlike the slumber parties my daughter used to have, at this one, at least, it looks like people actually got some sleep. But they knew that there would be a time when it was time to get up and go to the wedding feast, and so they all brought lamps. Now, remember, these are the days before ever-ready batteries and flashlights and all that, so they had actual lamps. Now, they were kind of crude little rascals. They had three component parts to a first-century lamp. The first was a bowl, just kind of a bowl thing. And in that you put oil, and then the third part was it had a wick on it. And you had to have all three parts, bowl, wick, and oil, for it to work. Now, if you had the bowl and the oil but no wick, it wouldn't work. If you had the bowl and the wick and no oil, it wouldn't work. If you had the oil and a wick and no bowl, it was a mess. I mean, you had to have all three parts. But for some reason, half of those young women thought they could get by with just two of the three components. They brought the lamp and the wick, but they didn't bring any oil with them. Now, I suppose if you had asked them, what are you thinking? Why don't you bring some oil so your lamp will work? That's, oh, we got that covered. See, when the time comes, we'll just borrow some oil from some of the other girls, and that'll work. Yeah, sure. So the time came, they all kind of slumbered and slept, and then all of a sudden, there was a knock on the door. You all come, it's time to come to the wedding feast. And just about the time that the five young women that had no oil were going to try to bum some from the other five young women, the five who came prepared jumped up, flicked their bicks, lit their wicks, and split out the door and left the foolish women in the dark, where rumor says you can find foolish women to this very day, but that's another story. You have to have a plan that has the potential to actually work, and it's not enough just to wish it or hope it or dream it. You have to actually do something about it. And I can prove that by quoting a great man. His name was T.E. Lawrence. But most people don't know him by that name. In his time, he had a more popular name. They called him Lawrence of Arabia. Hear these words. He says, all of us dream, but not equally. Those who dream at night in the dusty recesses of their mind awake and find that all is vanity. But the dreamers of the day are the dangerous ones, for they act out their dreams with open eyes, and they are the ones who make everything possible. Let us be dreamers of the day. The hardest part is just getting started. The second observation I want to share with you about this parable is that planning is not just for the wealthy. And most people have pretty much figured out, yes, those rich folks ought to have a will that includes charitable bequests to their church. Those folks with the wealth ought to do that. But it's too important just to leave it to the rich. One of the neat things about traveling the state of Michigan like I get to do is I get to go all around, even including up in the Upper Peninsula. As they say, it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from up there. And when I get up in the UP, I love to hear their stories. They tell these wonderful Uper stories. And one of my favorite ones about two Upper Peninsula lumberjacks. One was a great big husky fella. One was just a little shriveled up guy. Looked like he's getting over a hookworm treatment or something. And they're talking to each other one day. And the little guy looks up at the big lumberjack. He says, man, you are one big lumberjack. I wish I was big like you, because if I was big like you, you know what I would do? I'd go right into that woods, I'd find the biggest, orneriest black bear I could find, and I'd just whoop him up one side, and I'd whoop him down the other. That's what I would do if I was big like you. The big guy just listened for a moment. Then he said something pretty insightful. He said, see here, little man, there's plenty of small bears in that woods. You don't need to be rich to have a plan that can honor the Church of Jesus Christ. You know, this last year, talking about obituaries, some very famous and wealthy people have passed away in our community. Helen DeVos died just a little while ago. You heard they finally figured out how much money Helen DeVos left when she died. How much she left? All of it. And so will you. So you got something in common with the rich. Planning is not just for those who have significant wealth. A number of years ago, a woman died in central Michigan. And because she was married, she owned most everything jointly with her husband, so she didn't leave anything behind. Really, it all went to her spouse. But she did have a small life insurance policy that she owned in her own name. And that policy she used to make a charitable bequest. She dedicated that policy to provide camp scholarships for young people from her church. Every year since she's been gone, and that was in 1982, young people have gone to a United Methodist camping experience because of her insight to leave behind what she had. We can all do something. The hard part's getting started. It's not just for the rich. And here this final observation. Planning, particularly Christian estate planning, is your last chance to make a testimony. Testimony. Think about that. Maybe that's why we call that document a last will and testament. It's a testimony that says more about you than you might think. It says not only who you were, but what is important for you. And we have a problem in our denomination. We have a whole generation of people who live their entire lives as United Methodist Christians, but they die as agnostics because they leave behind no witness to their faith whatsoever. Or they leave it to their family, or they leave it to somebody else. Maybe they don't even bother to create a will of their own, and they default to the state-made will that the legislature in Lansing has passed that tells what's going to happen to your stuff unless you do something else about it. Live as Christians, die as agnostics. You got a new pastor this year. Good for you. Every year, young pastors more and more are calling me saying, I hate it where I am. How do I get out of here? And I wonder, you know, what goes in behind that. But there's an easy answer. It's, oh, you can move anytime you want to. Well, how do I do that? It's real simple. When the offering is received next Sunday, pray this prayer of dedication. Oh, Lord, in spite of what we say and do, this is what we think of you. Amen. You'll move that year, no question about it. Not because there's anything inaccurate about that statement. In fact, it's so accurate that it's challenging for more and more of our folks. They're not proud of what they're giving. They're not proud of what they're leaving. And we don't want to live a life that leaves nothing behind that says, yes, I'm a believer. Yes, the Church of Jesus Christ was important to me. Yes, I want to do something to say, look, I was here. I belong to this congregation, and I want to do something to make sure it's there for another generation, and this is what I'm doing about it. A number of years ago, a man died up in Cadillac, Michigan. I'll call him Clayton. The reason I call him that was his name. Pretty easy for me to call him that. Now, Clayton was a man shrouded in a lot of mystery. Not very many people knew Clayton very well. He belonged to the United Methodist Church there in Cadillac, but people said he was never very active here. He was never on any committees or anything. People didn't think he really cared all that much about the church. He and his wife had no children. People thought, well, it's probably because he didn't like children, because he had been known to yell at kids that walked across his grass. So the assumption people had was that Clayton was a guy who didn't really care much about anything. But I knew better. Boy, he'd asked me to be the trustee of his estate. And I was familiar with the terms of his trust. And it seemed strange to me that this man that they said didn't like children should build a house right next to the high school. That this man who they said was never active in his church was only inactive because he'd never been asked to be on a committee. As he told me, when you only get to the eighth grade in school, you don't get asked to be on a lot of committees. I wonder if that's a judgment on him or a judgment on his church. And then he died. It was my job as trustee to clear out all of his property, including having a huge estate sale at his home one Saturday morning. And I got there early before the estate sale and walked in by myself. I had a key. And there's something eerie bordering on the creepy of walking through a dead guy's house. And in his study was a huge roll-top desk. And in the desk, I saw some stuff I had to clear out, including his checkbook. And it occurred to me it might be kind of fun to see where the old man had been spending his money. And I was tempted strongly to peek. What would you do if you were in a dead guy's house all by yourself and you had a chance to look at his checkbook? Would you peek? I peeked. And I paged through that checkbook and I saw some strange things even I hadn't known about Clayton. This man that didn't seemingly care about children was a sucker for children. Every time that the Little League needed money for their new ball field, Clayton wrote a check. When the high school marching band needed new uniforms, Clayton wrote a check. When his youth fellowship at the church there in Cadillac had a chili supper for missions, he bought 20 tickets, even though Clayton couldn't eat chili. He couldn't digest that stuff at that stage of his life. But he bought 20 tickets, and there they were. And then it occurred to me, Wayne, someday you're going to be dead. And people are going to want to learn who you really were. And one way they're going to find out is they might look in your checkbook. They might look in your will. They might look in your trust to see what was really important to you. And I tell you, I could confess to you that I went home and I talked to my wife and we changed our trust to make it more a witness for the Church of Jesus Christ. Well, how about you? What's your testimony that you're making with your estate? Are you proud of it? Or do you want to do something else about it? If you'd like to do some changes, come and see us following this service. We're going to have a brief presentation just down the hall. We'll be happy to have you there. Because I believe that the future of the United Methodist Church is going to be determined by a few people. Not all of us, just a few. A few people who have the vision and the insight and the love to do something today to secure the church for tomorrow. I'd like to conclude by sharing with you what I hope would be called the Gospel According to Wayne, but that's not really what it is. It's from one much more insightful and knowledgeable than I am. He was a French theologian, scientist, and poet, a Jesuit priest. His name was Teilhard de Chardin. Hear these words with which he challenges the modern church. Someday after we've mastered the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, humankind will learn to harness for God the energies of human love. And then, for the second time in the history of the world, we truly will have discovered fire. My prayer for each and every one of you this morning, brothers and sisters, that you'd know the joy of that discovery in your life, and the lights of those fires might lead us to the church yet to be. God bless you.